You're listening to the Christian Humanist Radio Network, ChristianHumanist.org.
All the girls are complicated. Everyone is precious too, and you might get lucky if you do. Oh, you might get lucky if you do. Find the one that makes you laugh. Find the one that takes your breath, where you won't get everything that you want. Oh, but you'll need one to dote upon.
Hello and welcome to episode 198 of the Christian Feminist Podcast. I'm Victoria Reynolds Farmer, and with me today are Laurie Norris and Katie Grubbs. Hi, Laurie and Katie.
Hey.
Hi.
Let's introduce ourselves for anybody new to the program. Laurie, you start us off.
Hi, I'm Laurie Norris, and I am a perpetual grad student in Athens, Georgia, at the University of Georgia, and my current hobby is picking up new hobbies. So, I'm baking, and I've created a new recipe for making a ginger curd, and I'm teaching myself how to sew, and that's all to avoid doing the work that I don't want to do.
I think we all get new hobbies near the end of the dissertation process.
Yeah, I hopefully will actually revert back to writing sometime soon so that I can finish and defend this dissertation in the spring. Cross your fingers, say some prayers.
Definitely, I will. Also, ginger curd sounds amazing, friend.
So far, it tastes delicious.
Nice. Thanks, Laurie. Katie, how about you?
I'm Katie Grubbs. I live in Leeds, Alabama with my husband, David Grubbs. We're both English teachers, and we live here with our four children. I am adjunct professor of English for Houston Christian University, teaching fully online for my university. And then I'm also a substitute teacher in our local school district. So I spend a lot of days with a lot of different ages of kids. Last week I was with fifth graders on Monday and eighth grade social studies on Friday. So that was an interesting week.
Thanks, Katie. I'm sure they're all really grateful to have you. I know you're an amazing teacher, and I'm sure you're an amazing substitute as well.
Oh, thanks. I did get a gift today, which has never happened before.
Awesome.
One of my boys got in the car with a bag of like pumpkin ginger snaps from the fifth grade teacher I subbed for last week with a card thanking me for subbing in her class. I was floored. So it was really sweet.
That's super nice.
I know. Could also be a testament to how difficult that class was, if I'm being honest. But I'll take it. And she's a really sweet teacher.
In that case, that's just smart. Good for her.
Well, I know, because I would be more likely to go back now.
Thanks, Katie. I'm Victoria Reynolds Farmer. I'm one of the founding members of the CFP. For my day job, I work in engagement at a market research firm for fun. In addition to doing this podcast, I like to read and write and think about things like gender and ability and culture and embodiment. And I play the ukulele. I have a doctorate in Renaissance literature and gender studies from Florida State University. And I also spend a little bit of time volunteering at the high school where my husband, Michael Farmer, teaches. All right, everybody. So let's jump into this month's episode, which is about the tradwife phenomenon. The reason that I wanted to do this episode is because I feel like not only is this something that is really having a kind of zeitgeisty moment, but it is something that is having a moment that does kind of encompass all of the wheelhouses of our show. It's about a particularly interesting nexus of gender and religion that I thought we would have interesting things to say about. I also just kind of wanted to make my smart friends read about what is one of my, let's be honest, guilty pleasures. I am someone who has followed lots and lots of conservative blogger influencers for lots of years. Before the word tradwife really entered the scene, which happened in about 2018, I would say I was reading these influencers' blogs and following them on social media for a good 10 years before that. So it's been kind of wild to see lots of people in wider culture talking about these kind of folks, when I've been kind of shame reading them for lots of time. So that's my personal reason, both kind of the smart reason and the sillier reason, for digging into this on the show. What are y'all's experiences with tradwives? Did you know much about them before this episode? How about you, Katie?
On a personal level, if you take away the kind of social media and the aesthetics aspect of it, I guess I am a trad wife in the sense that I'm the anchor parent in our house and I'm doing the most, most of the childcare for our kids. But I wasn't super familiar with it as an online phenomenon until the pretty recent past. The first kind of thing was I started noticing randomly all these videos in my feed of like ladies preparing their husbands' lunches for work. And I was like, okay. I mean, I do make David's lunch for work because otherwise he would be like, I'm good, and just not eat, and that's not acceptable to me. So I pack his lunch. But this was like particularly these videos were very performative. It was like, watch me get up at 3 a.m. and make my husband an elaborate lunch, or watch me make lunch for my husband and all of his coworkers in our RV. And I'm like, this. I was thinking, this is a lot, and I'm wondering why we're feeling the need to broadcast this into the
Oh,
ether.
so that person is hitting two hashtags. They've got hashtag trad wife and hashtag van life at once. That's a lot, man.
I know that lady was knocking it out of the park, I suppose, with her bucket full of homemade tamales, which, to be honest, looked delicious. But then I had started to hear the word, but I wasn't completely sure what it meant in terms of the online kind of environment until you kind of assigned us these readings. And so then when I read through the things that you gave me to read, and then I kind of, did some more of my own research too, just kind of reading up about the different people who are the big names and the different types or strands of it. So as a phenomenon, it is new to me, even though technically I suppose I've been living that lifestyle for a long time in a much more I don't know what the word is, more nuanced, more low-key, more balanced way than a lot of these situations that we read about.
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't call you a trad wife because of the nuance and also because you're not the, well, three reasons. The nuance, the lack of aesthetic, and you're not trying to recruit people. So like
That's true. That's really true.
a lot of these people are doing this to make a particular religious sect or a particular group kind of look better, and it's a recruiting tool, which we'll talk more about that because Tia Levings gets into that pretty deep. But Laurie, what were you gonna say?
I think another big distinction between the life that Katie lives and the life that these women claim to live is that David is not abusive.
That's true. Though I am interested when we get to Tia's reading to talk about if we think that it is possible for somebody to be in a situation like this that is, is trafficking in these different kinds of languages and in which people are living these particular different roles that is not actively abusive. Because I think there could be a situation where there's not like it's not Tia's situation, but it's still not great. But I get what you're saying. And it is also true that I think, to be truthful though, pretty much every woman I know in real life who thinks of herself as living, a more traditional life in the sense that the mom is the anchor parent, that was always how it was going to be in terms of that's what the husband and wife decided before they even had any kids. All the people I know like that, all of those moms also have like another job. Like none of us are only wives, mothers, homemakers. And not that I don't know women like that, but the ones that are my closest friends. So also I think, I wonder, and all the, I'm gonna save that though. When we read about the ballerina farm lady, like she has a job and her job is marketing her life. She's not just a homemaking mom. But that's kind of a soapbox of mine. We could talk about it later.
Yes. So let's talk about that now, actually. The next question on our list here is, what is a trad wife and what is not a trad wife? So I'm going to read a little bit from the Wikipedia definition, because I felt like that was a good, like, straight down the middle place to start. And then let's kind of tease that out a little bit, talk about how the readings might respond to that, whatever direction you two want to go. A tradwife, neologism for traditional wife or traditional housewife, is a woman who believes in and practices traditional gender roles in marriage. Some may choose to take a homemaking role within their marriage, and others leave their careers to focus on meeting their family's needs in the home. According to Google Trends, online searches of the term tradwife began to rise in popularity around mid-2018 and reached high levels during the early 2020s. The traditional housewife aesthetic has since spread throughout the internet, in part through social media featuring women extolling the virtues of behaving as the ideal woman. The tradwife subculture is based on advocating for traditional values, and in particular, a, quote, traditional view of wives as mothers and homemakers. Tradwives are diverse demographically, may have a variety of cultural inspirations. Influences on trend range from 1950s-era American culture, Christian religious values, conservative politics, and in some cases, neo-paganism. A little bit further down the page, key to the tradwife identity is being a stay-at-home wife or stay-at-home mother, and various activities involved in managing the household, such as cooking, cleaning, managing laundry, and tending vegetable gardens. Additionally, special attention is paid to the importance of raising children. All right, I'll stop there. Thoughts about any of this definition?
That seems like a very civil and politic description, and I think it kind of misses the connotations of tradwife, because that's what the phrase denotes.
Talk about the connotations then, Laurie.
So the connotations, you cannot divorce tradwife, hashtag tradwife, from, like Katie was getting at, these women who are selling a version of themselves online. And it's all part of like the mommy wars and the horrible thing about social media, where it's like everybody else's life is perfect, why isn't mine? You cannot use tradwife, like the slang, without it immediately connoting these women with 40 kids, and they're all blonde, and they're all in handmade luxury clothing, and their houses are covered in antiques that are very expensive, and they manage to do everything somehow, ignoring the fact that they're all ridiculously wealthy people. So what Wikipedia there is like, let's admit that there are people out there who honestly believe in traditional gender roles and values, and let's not try to insult them to their face, but tradwife, you don't say that and like not immediately think of a stereotype. And the stereotype is there because it allows these women to profit through social media and through these videos of a version of their life that is not entirely accurate.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. And the profit can be monetary in the case of Hannah Nealman, but isn't always. Like Tia Levings in the excerpt we'll talk about when we get to her book, talks about a kind of social profit. This idea that if you fit a particular culture's role of what the perfect wife is, you get a kind of social capital that allows you to kind of spread this gospel of wifehood to other women and gain power through remaking other young women in your image, which is interesting too.
I think it's like that multi-level marketing, but without the stockpiles of rotting leggings.
I mean, there's a lot of overlap, right? Lots of trad wives, in fact, get involved in MLMs because it's an acceptable kind of feminized way to earn money for their family. But this is not an MLM episode, so we're not gonna. we're not going to do that. But yes, I mean, there is actual overlap there. What were you going to say, Katie?
I was going to say, I also took a look at the Wikipedia article before we got started tonight, and somewhere in there it mentioned something about it being, the whole trad wife thing being more related to class than, like, race or religion or any other signifier, though I do think religion's a big part of it, too. And I thought that was an astute observation, because Laurie's right. You can't live that exact aesthetic without money. You just can't, or you kill yourself. I mean, like, you either never sleep and, you know, try to homestead, you know, or try to glamorize, you know, the hard part of actually, like, you know, living out there and with your own bees and making your own butter and all that kind of stuff, and or you have a lot of money that makes it possible for you to, you know, have the time to make all of these different foods from scratch and, you know, while taking care of your, like, 19 children. And I think that that's something, and I think that's why it is aspirational. There are, you know, probably a lot of women out there who enjoy looking at that stuff, reading that stuff, watching those videos, because they really wish they had the time and also the money to be able to make their own sourdough and, you know, hand sew all clothes for their many children and all this kind of stuff. So I think it's, it is, but that's true of all aesthetics. And that's the other thing is I keep thinking about how this aesthetic is particularly annoying, but in some ways it's similar to other kind of online aesthetics that seem kind of cozy and lovely and like something that would be cool to do, but at the bottom of it, when you get down to it, costs a lot of money. And the one I'm particularly thinking of are, and I love them and I watch them all the time, but all the people who hand sew historical garments with historical accuracy. I love that stuff. Like, I eat it up. I love to read it and I love to watch it. But the truth is, if you're going to do that, you need a whole lot of time. Like, either you don't work, or, and that is your job, is making content, making your fancy historical garments. You need a whole lot of time. You need a whole lot of money to buy the fabrics, to buy the things, to have the stuff. Like, you know, I don't know. It feels kind of similar to me in the sense that it's kind of billed as, it's a simpler life. It's a simpler way. We're going to hand sew these Edwardian garments, like Bernadette Banner. But it still takes money and time. Like,
I love her. Bernadette's great. But so now that we're talking about money, that seems like a perfect segue into the first article we're going to discuss, which is a Sunday Times article about Hannah Nealman, probably the most famous of the online trad wives, who goes by at Ballerina Farm. The title of the article is Meet the Queen of the Trad Wives and Her 8 Children. And it's a profile ostensibly of Hannah Nealman, but there's a ton of her husband in it, either by accident or on purpose, depending on who you ask. It caused a firestorm online, with people reacting to it, and also Nealman and her husband have kind of clapped back and said that they really object to the way they're portrayed in it. But she is the most famous of the trad wives, was before this article came out, and it made quite a stir culturally. So let's talk about it. What did you expect from this article, and did you get what you expected?
I think I expected it to be a little bit more both sidesist. this, I can understand why the Neelmans might be mad about this, but also, I gotta be honest, it met my expectations of a super rich husband sort of steamrolling over his otherwise incredibly talented wife and not really giving her a chance to do anything of her own volition. There's a line in it somewhere that to the effect of that the journalist was never quite able to get her alone or to get Hannah to answer a question without her husband or her kids jumping in and interrupting. And that is a particular posture that the journalist is taking. And it's one that, you know, satisfies what me as the anti-trad wife would expect. But then, you know, it put up my hackles. It was like, hey, maybe this woman really might be getting, like, her husband could be a controlling jerk, but he's also the son of a billionaire, so he's a spoiled brat no matter what's going on. Maybe give her own chance, a platform. You could have worked out a way that she comes off looking a little bit less harried.
Yeah, the question that I've written about this is this responsible journalism? I think I'm going to change that and say, like, is this journalism? Because I'm not sure it's actual reporting. I think it might be, I mean, I'm not sure it's even really an opinion piece. I'm not sure what I would classify this as. What would the two of you classify it as, journalistically speaking?
That's difficult. I don't know. I mean, because it weirdly has the, I honestly, it feels like an expose, but is the best word I can think of, just because it has that air of, I'm going to get to the bottom of this. And, you know, with the, and the kind of, in terms of the editorial tone of, you know, it was very crystal clear what the author's idea was going in, and that idea was mostly unchanged coming out.
Right.
And so I don't know. It's difficult to classify. And when I was reading it, in terms of my I went into it with no expectations because I didn't know anything about her. I didn't know, I didn't know this article was controversial. I knew nothing. So I just read it, and I kind of had two feelings going on at the same time. On the one hand, my hackles were definitely up, like Laurie said, particularly when it was mentioned by the husband, which he didn't have to say this, but particularly when it was mentioned that she, like, has to take to her bed from exhaustion for like a week sometimes. I'm like, this is, there's something else happening here, because yeah, this is a, these are people with three full-time employees. And I get that he didn't want nannies, so they don't have a nanny or whatever, but they also pay a lady from down the road to homeschool their children. Like, she's apparently not teaching them every day. Like, it was weird to me that anybody with that much money would ever take to the bed with exhaustion if there's not something else going on.
Yeah, right. That was like a massive red flag.
I was like, what's happening?
A forest of red flags. Well, and so many red flags.
And it could be any number of red flags. It could, I mean, it could be an eating disorder. Like, it doesn't necessarily mean, you know, like, when she takes to her bed with exhaustion, it's because she's got to wait for the bruises to heal. Like, I don't know. But at the same
time. Also, like, the fact, though, that the article literally uses that phrase, it says takes to her bed, which is like such a Victorian, like,
and that was the, and that I was got the writer's so, words, not yeah, her husband's words, right, either, because right. That wasn't an exact quote like that. I was like, what is that? Like,
yeah, I got really frustrated with this, and like Laurie said, I admit it, I have hate watched Hannah Neelman's Instagram channel for years. I hate on her. I talk about her $300,000 vintage stove and like how it's all an act. You know, I've been doing this forever. But I still think this article was like super annoying because it doesn't, it, like you said, Katie, it doesn't do what journalism is supposed to do. It's clear what the author thinks going in, and it's clear that she doesn't really care that her thought pattern doesn't evolve coming out of it. And I agree with her. I agree with her 100%, but like, it is her job to do better than that and go deeper than that. particularly if what she says is at stake here. Because what happens when you publish an article like this is you give people who you don't agree with politically perfect ammunition to be like, this was a hatchet job. This is not what we're trying to do. We're just a nice traditional family. So I feel like it's like it's counterproductive to what the author was actually seemingly trying to do.
Particularly because they're she I and maybe I only felt this way because I have not as I only have half as many children as Nieleman, but she seemed to be lumping in together the interruptions and, you know, the chaos of the little children with the seeming coercion or control of the husband. But the truth
Not
is,
remotely the same thing, by the way.
it's not,
Like,
yeah, it's not. Like, the truth is, anytime there are any, if any of my children are in a room and I'm trying to talk to anybody, I'm going to get interrupted at minimum every 5 minutes. And that's just because they don't have situational awareness to realize that they're interrupting. And then mine get corrected. And then they're like, oh, sorry, whatever. But that's not at all the same thing as her husband talking over her or talking for her, you know. But the writers seem to be just lumping all that in together, like as if everybody in the home, even the tiny little babies, were all oppressing this woman. Like, and the other thing that frustrated me a little bit, but again, I have to keep reminding myself that I have a different personality type, almost certainly than Neeleman. I was not raised traditional Mormon, which is a huge piece of this. But you know, the kind of rehearsal of all of their life together and how it began and how it continued, it seems like that she just kind of let things happen to her. You know, she's like, oh, I, you know, I was going to be a ballerina, but then, but you know, but he said we need to get married right away. So, okay. Like, you know, and it reminded me of Tia's piece of, you know, that kind of, and not, I mean, again, you know, if she's been raised traditional Mormon, it is entirely possible that she felt like that was, that she did not have a choice. But I kept thinking, well, hold on. Like, you know, especially now, you know, she's the face of this massive brand, making, you know, her family all this money. If even if she felt like she was in an unbalanced relationship before, because her husband's, you know, of a family of billionaires, she's the famous one now. And so, you know, you would think that there'd be, you know, some cloud, or I don't know. I guess I wondered at times. I wondered if there, you know, was the writer ever going to talk about, like, you know, or explore at all, like how Hannah felt about her choices, because she made choices. Like, she, you know, I can, I don't know, I'm trying to figure out what I want to say about that. But it, the writer seemed to have this idea that all this was just like has been just kind of forced on her. And but there's also, it can be some of both. There, you know, these are also choices that she made. There are also choices she made over time that led to the life that she's living now. And it's tough to suss that out. And the writer didn't seem super interested in, you know, any of those choices along the way that Neeleman maybe owns and would have made again, and that aren't, you know, I don't know.
I think the
She.
writer needed to interrogate a little bit more, like, how frickin' young these women are when they get married. Hannah, I'm looking at the, okay, so I'm looking at the actual article on the internet, and it's got this, frankly, a gorgeous picture of the whole family with everyone's ages listed. And so their oldest child is 12, and in this picture, Hannah is 34. Please correct me if I'm wrong, but that means she's 22 when she has the kid, right? So that means she's like
Yeah.
20, 21 when they're getting married. Can you imagine? Look back on yourself in your mind right now at 20-year-old you. What kind of an idiot are you? Like, your brain is not done baking. And this family, like, her husband's the same way. He's like an hour older than her. And so they're children making these massive decisions for each other, facilitated by the hoarding of wealth. And I think that needs to be interrogated. The idea that a 19-year-old, a 20-year-old should be starting a family is.
I mean, is I understand what you're saying, but also, A, incredibly common for most of human history. B, still incredibly common in conservative religious environments. I
And
mean,
will always creep me out.
I grew up just kind of run-of-the-mill evangelical. I was engaged at 22 and married at 23. I was not immediately popping out babies, thank goodness. But, I mean, conservatives in general, don't get mad at me, everyone listening to this, but conservatives in general think that that families make adults rather than that adults make families, right? And liberals tend to think that adults make families.
I don't know that I will ever really understand as like the exact opposite of this target audience. Like, I know about trad wives because the algorithm regularly presents me homesteaders who are like, hey, do you want to learn how to make cheese but also wear pants and have autonomy? I'm like, yes, I do need a new hobby. And I grew up in mainline Protestant church that said, hey, ask questions. You're great. You're weird, and that's wonderful. So I will never, like, this is baffling to me, as if I was looking in on an alien civilization entirely.
Victoria, I think that's actually a really good way to put it in one sentence. Because,
and I will say it's not mine. I stole it from the book Red Families, Blue Families, which I used to use when I taught sociology at a Bible college, which is a wild thing to do sometimes.
Yeah. And I mean, I do. And you're right. I mean, my mom and dad got married when they were almost 19, and I was born when they were 21. And they're still together. Now, a lot of their friends aren't. But I don't think that's necessarily to do with age in all those cases. And I went to, which, just hold on to your hats, guys. I'm not intentionally trying to make all of us feel like we're 85 years old. A couple months ago, we went to the wedding of our flower girl, Olivia, the little one, the one who was three at our wedding. She just got married. She and her new husband are both 19 or 20. In their case, he's working, they met in high school, like, you know, right at the end of high school or whatever. She did her first year of college, and then they got married this summer. But in their case, he was working a job. She's doing her college degree in like construction management. She spends all her time with a hard hat on. So he moved to Mississippi with her for her to continue her college degree. So they are very young married, but also not really following the trad wife template. You know what I mean? Like, so it's an interesting thing. And I'm not going to lie, I was surprised to hear they were getting married that young. Like, because I've gotten so calibrated to kind of people getting married older now. But also we've spent so long in the academic environment where, you know, later marriages or no marriages are like definitely the norm.
Yeah, standards are very different.
Yes,
and depending on what group you occupy. Yeah,
that's kind of been where we've been hanging out. But I do think that, and I also think there's a difference between young marriage and young parenthood too. One thing I noticed in the article that I did think the writer seemed upset, not upset. The writer seemed like was a bad thing. Or like a red flag, and I didn't necessarily see it that way because I kind of grew up in this atmosphere, is one of the, maybe even one of the captions on one of the photographs, they had a photo of Needleman, like, as the white swan or something. And underneath the picture, it said, you know, that when I grew up, I wanted to be a ballerina, but I knew that once I had children, my life would begin to change. And this was presented probably to look scary. Though when I saw that, that made perfect sense to me. One, because that was not something that was coming from her husband, because that's her talking about her childhood, right? So that's the way she was raised coming out. So it's not just, you know, he told me that I'm going to have babies right away, or that you know, that I can't keep doing, you know, what I want for my career after I have children. Like, that was something she expected to do and was presumably wanted to do. But that was also very much when I grew up, like, we kind of had a feeling, I don't know, I guess I was assuming that once we had kids that my life would change. Like, even though as I got older, you know, I went to not a Christian college, I went to grad school, I did all these things, I had these plans, and I did all of the things, you know, that I was planning on doing, but the whole time I never had the idea that, oh, I can, my life's going to keep being exactly the way that I want it. And once we start a family, I'm going to keep doing all those same things and somehow fit a kid into the spaces, right? Because I do think that growing up evangelical, that is one thing that gets in you. If you're a woman, regardless of whatever other plans you have, is that at the very least, if you have a child or any children, your life will change in a big way. Like the shape of it will change in a big way, even if you continue plan to continue working. And I think that that's, a little bit different than the secular world, where not so much anymore, thankfully, because people are finally thinking about work-life balance. But in that kind of girl boss era, that she mentioned in the article, at least on the secular side, there was this attempt to suggest that you could keep living your life in a way that was mostly unchanged and somehow fit kids in around it, which is not super possible.
Right.
Yeah, I think though there's a big difference between like the reasonable acknowledgement that yes, now I am responsible for an entire another life. I have to do things a little bit differently than the let me subsume myself entirely to something else's demands. Like
That's true.
the erasure of herself is what really seems to stick in my craw the most. It's like, and it comes across in the way that the journalist is always positioning her husband talking over Neelman, but it really does seem like so much of her own like personhood was expected to be dissolved into the needs of her children and the desires of her husband.
And you get that with the kind of overhanging metaphor of her ballet studio, right? They talk about how,
And the pageant dresses.
The way that the ballet studio becomes it's the only space that's supposed to be reserved for her, and then there's this faux offhanded remark from the journalist that, oh, it became her kids' schoolroom. And I like, yes, I understand what she's trying to say, and yes, to a degree, I do think that this is a woman who, it seems, if any of this is to be believed at all, doesn't seem to have a lot of control over her life. But also, it's so disingenuous, right? Like the way this is written about is in such bad faith. She doesn't try to understand why Neeleman is making these choices. Indeed, as Katie says, she is complicit in stripping her of her agency in the way the article is constructed. She writes her like this is someone that all of this stuff happened to, from him picking the seat on the plane on through. Except the only choice she makes for herself, she makes when her husband isn't there, when she decides to have an epidural. Which she seems to enjoy. But this article made me so angry because I like couldn't even happily hate read it because I was like, this person who has the same point of view as me is also doing this all wrong. And then it made me interrogate why I like to hate read and watch this stuff, and I felt bad about myself, which is probably a good thing.
Well, because it made you're totally right, and now that I think about it, it's like the writer wanted. It really felt like the writer wanted that to be the reality. Like she wanted it to be no more complicated than this is a poor lady whose husband and children have consumed her life, and to
Right,
the
and
because.
that's not how human beings work.
No, well, and when she kept, complaining about like, oh, her husband won't leave and he takes me to look at ditches and the kids won't leave. She could have called Neeleman on the phone to get the rest of what she wanted from her. Like there are ways that she could have corresponded with this lady or, I mean, like, but she chose to come to the farm for the full experience. Like it felt to me like she wasn't going to push or she didn't try to have a private conversation. As much as she could have, and why? Is it because it would, potentially could have upset this image that she's, and but again, though, she's kind of putting up a false image, but at the same time, all of the trad wives, I think, are putting up not super real, true to life images of their own lives. because it's all an aesthetic anyway. You know, so, and especially I think for ones who don't have the resources of a Hannah Nealeman, you know, like younger or less better established women who are trying for this aesthetic, a lot of it is probably smoke and mirrors.
Right.
You know, and they're trying to, you know, to act like they're living this life or to present an image of this life that is, you know, not real. And a lot of it is based on ideas about the past that aren't real, you know?
So that's actually a perfect segue into our next reading. It's an excerpt from a book called The Well-Trained Wife by maybe my favorite ex-fundamentalist influencer, Tia Levings. And yes, I do have a favorite ex-fundamentalist influencer. I follow lots of them. Tia was a member of a Baptist church in Florida that became entangled with the IBLP, the Institute of Basic Life Principles, a Christian group led by Bill Gothard, who you've definitely heard me talk about on this podcast before. Famous members of the IBLP include the Duggar family and the Bates family, both of whom had TLC reality shows. So Tia wrote this book because she escaped an abusive fundamentalist marriage, and she is one of those people that Katie referred to, someone who is living the trad wife lifestyle without the aesthetics and without the money to back it up. So let's start there. What do these two women we've read about have in common, and how are they different?
There's something, I think the biggest difference for me is not just in the way that these two stories are presented, in that the journalist is also like still punching down. So if the journalist really did believe that Hannah Nealeman was in a position like Tia Levings was, she's just continuing the cycle of abuse. Whereas Levings being able to tell her own story and interrogate her own experiences herself is breaking free of that abuse and is starting to embrace honesty, though she is also still profiting from her relationship to this aesthetic and to this sort of posture.
Though let's be clear, though, that Tia was never, like, she never had a trad wife Instagram or anything like that. She just was a part of this group. She did have a blog where she kind of participated in the recruiting that she talks about, though it is also blogs that save her from fundamentalism. So I don't know that they're doing the same thing in terms of aesthetics.
I do think it changes it that it's a memoir and that she's telling her own story, because you get the chance to get those unfiltered or unmediated thoughts. And particularly given in the chapter you gave us to read, how much she talked about how she very consciously buried all of her own emotions and all of her own warning bells that were ringing in her head, and to put up a particular attitude to friends and family. And, you know, by her writing out her story now, you get behind those walls. I appreciated the degree to which, and it must have been so difficult when she was writing it, I appreciated the degree to which she put in everything, you know, put in so many different aspects of her husband, including one, like, she didn't leave out any, she didn't choose to omit anything that could have made you have any ounce of sympathy for him, right? Like, she included him talking about things in his past, like in his childhood, that, you know, probably started his cycle of abuse towards her. Like, she allowed him to be a three-dimensional person while still making it very clear that this was absolutely wrong and abusive and terrible for her. And that, I think, is one of the biggest differences between the two readings, is that in the reading about Nealeman and her family, from that writer's not presenting to me anybody in that household three-dimensionally. the you know, Neelam and her husband, the children, they all seem kind of like characters. And you get the sense that there's more going on below the surface, but the writer doesn't necessarily seem to be interested in presenting them in a round way. But Tia is presenting herself, you know, her abusive husband, like everybody in her memoir feels like a real person because they are real people, but so are the Neelmans. Does that make sense? Like,
yeah, 100%. And I will say, like, that's why she's one of my favorite Instagram followers. Follows. We are not mutual followers. Maybe one day I will achieve that.
I hope so.
But the thing that, like, really made me start digging into her in a deeper way after she came across my feed was that she is incredibly charitable to people who, in one way or another, sucked her into this way of life that took her to a very bad place. She says, you know, it makes sense to me. It's a totally human impulse to want to have the answers to understand how to make your children good, moral, character-driven people. Like, these people just wanted to raise good families, and that is a good impulse. And, you know, yes, it went off the rails, and yes, they should at some level be held accountable for that, but their guiding impulse was a good one. And I think to be able to come out of the other side of harrowing abuse that is described in this memoir and still hold people complicit but also have compassion toward them, I have such admiration for that.
Particularly, I particularly appreciated it because I know multiple people who came from that same environment, from that kind of Gothardy milieu, including my own husband. And so knowing, you know, and I don't know anybody who has a story like Tia's, that, you know, in terms of that abusive side of it. And I think part of that is because, you know, David, his family, the other people we know who were part of that made an exit a long time ago and, you know, weren't continuing to be involved. And so by the time, you know, David and his friends were old enough to marry and things like that, they were gone from that situation, which is a blessing. Personally knowing people who went through that kind of environment, I really appreciated the way that she, you know, the way that she talked about the people that were part of her life. My favorite part of that whole chapter was the scene with the premarital counseling.
That's my favorite too. So let's talk about that.
Okay. Well, and because you would, and I don't know, having not read the entire memoir, I don't know if her family was involved in that stuff through their church or if it was like in a parachurch way.
It was through their church. I'll mention the church by name because she does. And because I think it's important to talk about how mainstream Gothardism kind of became in certain segments of evangelicalism. It's First Baptist Jacksonville, Florida, and and there are for the years that she talks about, like they are doing, like basic seminars are being streamed into First Baptist there.
That's wild. I was so kind of surprised reading that scene or that, you know, that portion of the chapter, because knowing what I know about the Gothard environment and I was actually incredibly surprised that the older male minister who was doing this counseling was very clearly trying to warn her that this is a terrible idea. Like, that was really surprising to me because having read the chapter up to that point and knowing what I know about that environment, I was expecting there to be no kind of consideration for her feelings. No, like, that was really interesting to me that he was trying to prevent a disaster. And, you know, in her case, she didn't take that out. That was another thing I appreciated about this chapter is that she kept showing times when she could have kind of retreated. She could have stepped back, but she didn't. And that's also presenting herself as a round person, right? She's presenting herself as a person who had some times when she could have made a different choice, but she didn't. And that also made it really interesting.
Right, because it's the opposite of kind of the way that the journalist in the Sunday Times article portrays Hannah Nealman. She yes. is a kind of complex person with agency. Yeah, I really loved that scene with the marriage counseling scene because, well, first of all, it's someone else in her life saying, like, reaching out to her and saying, hey, are you sure about this? And he says, you know, this personality is going to overwhelm this personality. And I don't know what your experience of premarital counseling was, Katie, but mine didn't feel super deep. I mean, we kind of talked about some deep issues, but I feel like there wasn't a lot of like probing going on. So I really appreciated his like substantive comments there.
We did double premarital counseling because when Dave and I got engaged, my parents didn't know anything about him at all or his family but P.S. this is incredibly Southern, other than that they had shared a pastor at one point, like our pastor left and then went to David's church and that made them feel better. but because they didn't know the pastor David's parents' church was going to perform our wedding, and he was like, I won't perform your wedding unless we do like a couple of sessions, and we were like, that's fine. But then my parents were like, well, we don't know him, like we don't know his deal, so would you please, it was not a command, it was like a request, would you mind also doing a couple of sessions with Pastor Dan at our church? And we were like, okay. So we were doubly premarital counseled, and I mean, it was pretty in depth. I definitely remember the whole personality questionnaire thing that she talks about. We didn't do that at my parents' church, but we did do that at David's parents' church. And I do remember Pastor Thad telling me that my results didn't make sense, which annoyed me. not didn't make sense with David, but didn't make sense in me as a person. Like there was something about my responses that he felt like was odd or that didn't make a whole lot of sense to him in terms of how my personality operated. And I'm still kind of,
probably it's because you're such an ambivert.
Probably. But so it felt pretty in depth. I don't remember any of that, like more, I don't remember any really intense probing, though I do remember getting teary in one of our sessions at my parents' church, only because we were talking about something, maybe, you know, what my expectations were for marriage or something that I hadn't realized was emotional for me. But given my own experience of premarital counseling being fairly innocuous, that was another thing about that scene that surprised me reading this, was that he just straight up said, I think this is a bad idea and I would not recommend it. That floored me because I've never heard of that happening to anybody that I personally know.
Yeah, it must, right?
I hope so, because I kind of feel like that's their job.
Yeah, I mean, if you really think, because I mean, in terms of what marriage is, you know, what God has joined together, let no man put asunder. Both, I was about to be really rude and be like, even Protestants think, sorry, Protestants.
That's all right, we're not offended, it's fine.
But, just Catholic sacramental marriage is different than, Protestant marriage, but both Protestants and Catholics, I'll say that and be nicer, you know, think that marriage is very important and try not to let divorce enter the picture if they could help it. So, yeah, I do think, like, if that's what you think, you do have a responsibility if marriage is that serious and you think that these people aren't compatible to tell them that. Absolutely. Laurie, you're not saying a lot in this portion of the proceedings. What did you think about this memoir?
This was the scariest work of horror that I have read all spooky season. There's nothing about this that doesn't make my skin crawl.
It was very unsettling, especially on my first reading. The second time I was able to look through it and think more about what I wanted to say. But yeah, the first time I was just very disturbed. And I read it right before bed, which didn't help.
Yeah, this experience is so divorced from the way I was raised and the God that I was raised to know personally, and it hurts my heart that any human being experiences this in the name of faith. I'm getting worked up. Even I'm reading back over some of these passages now, and I'm just so angry that people use the name of God to be so abusive.
It's truly sickening. And I that's the thing that I appreciate most about this memoir. And I would recommend everyone who's listening to this, if you're interested at all, pick up The Well-Trained Wife and read it. It's a quick read. I read the whole thing in like a day and a half, though it is, as we've said here, a quite emotional read as well. And I will say thank you, ladies. I did give you what was basically the most harrowing chapter of the entire book. And I debated not doing that, but I feel like it really, I thought it went really well with the other piece, and also that it just kind of gets at the heart of Tia's project and what she's trying to illuminate. So I did it. But thank you both for trudging through that. I know it was a tough read. Any other passages that you want to talk about other than the counseling passage?
For me, the one that really like stuck in my gut was when they're going to walk her down the aisle, and she cannot see at all because of this veil. I was like, okay, I get your metaphor. But when her father turns to her and asks her, are you sure you want to do this? And like, how do you not see that this is God giving you an out? How do you, like, I want to go back in time and hug this woman and lead her away from this abuse.
It's really interesting to me too, because, you know, the fact that her dad asked, you're right, Laurie, that part was really interesting, because the fact that her dad asked her suggests to me that he thought something maybe was up. And she made a point of mentioning that the pastor who did their premarital counseling knows her parents. So did he mention, like, did he warn her parents? And it's interesting to me, given how much in Gothard subculture the parents' word and rule is, just how important that it is. It is wild to me that neither of her parents thought to forbid the union.
Yeah.
If they had any idea of what was going on.
It seems like, though, especially, I mean, in this chapter, but definitely in the rest of the memoir, she seems to be kind of drinking the Gothard Kool-Aid a little more than her parents are. Because it's the youth group that really gets her sucked into it. And the person who, I can't remember if this happens in this chapter or not, but like she's talking to a girlfriend of hers about how angry, I don't even remember the man's name. What's her husband's name?
Alan.
So she's talking to a girlfriend about how angry Alan gets, and the girlfriend is just like, that's being married, you need to submit more.
Well, she tells the one friend, and the one friend is like, but you're gonna get engaged and it's gonna be fine because you can read this book. Yeah, I remember that. That was in this chapter. And because I was really upset by that, you know, but you know what though, that kind of tracks, to be honest, because I think the Gothard thing was kind of a piece with the whole Joshua, what's his name?
Harris.
Yes, like all of that kind of stuff. I think there were a lot of younger people or teens who kind of got swept up in that stuff, like back in the late 80s, early 90s. Because I remember, you know, that like I remember watching stuff like the Duggars or learning about like some of that stuff. And I mean, you know, I was a young teenager, in the late 90s. And my parents were very conservative evangelicals who went to a Baptist churches or Bible churches, but they never once were like, you need to be courting. Like, they were expecting, I mean, they gave me limits on when I could start dating, but when it came to dating, they were envisioning it the way that they dated in the late 70s. Like, you know what I mean? They were more, my mom and dad were, you know, more liberal than a lot of the stuff that, like, some young, you know, kind of gothard evangelicals were doing. So it's maybe not surprising to me that Tia's parents were potentially less into it or less deep into it than she and her friends were.
Okay, well, it's probably time to transition into our last segment, where we make recommendations on things we think you should watch, read, or listen to, either related to this topic or not. And thank you both for your discussion. I've really enjoyed talking about this with you. Okay, Laurie, what recommendation do you have for us?
Okay. As the network's resident spooky girl, and it being mid-October when we're recording this, I have to recommend a horror film. So I am going to recommend to everybody a Hulu movie. It was part of one of their streaming anthology series, Into the Dark, released in 2019, called Pure, directed by Hannah McPherson, and starring Jakara Smith, also known as Sailor J of the infamous Contorn YouTube video, you know, that the men will know that we have features. She's fabulous. Go watch that.
Oh, yeah. The men will know that we can shapeshift and they will tell the church.
Yes.
Yes, that was hilarious.
Yeah, so she stars in the movie Pure, which is about purity balls and what it takes to its logical extreme. What happens when you have a bunch of young women push back against their hypocritical, abusive, fundamentalist Christian fathers? And while it is not the best made movie, it is competently made. It is interesting. And Smith is quite good as Shay. So Pure on Hulu from 2019.
Thanks, Lori. What do you got for us, Katie?
Okay, I'm going to recommend a documentary, which is not directly related to what we talked about tonight, but is interestingly presents an interesting image of a real life wife. So I watched last week or the week before a new documentary that just came out on Netflix in September called Apollo 13 Survival. And I grew up as a young person absolutely loving the Tom Hanks Apollo 13 movie. I love space. I love survival stories. But this new documentary is the reason somebody made a new documentary, which directed by, Peter Middleton, I believe. Yeah, Peter Middleton, is because there's been new footage released that was taken at the time, of the things that were happening. But also, the filmmakers were given access to a massive trove of home movies and pictures by Jim Lovell's family. And so I sat down to watch it. It's like an hour and a half long. And it was absolutely fascinating because with the addition of all those different kind of family documents, you get a huge insight into Marilyn Lovell and what she was going through at the time.
She is the coolest. I am also obsessed with early space stuff, and like Marilyn Lovell is a complete rock star and nobody knows, and it's very sad. Yeah, I'm definitely going to check this documentary out.
You should watch it. What is wild to me is that she was going through all of these things. Like I told David after I finished watching it, I said, who was taking these pictures? Who was taking photographs? Because, you know, one of her girls, and the other interesting thing about this documentary too, is that they have recorded voices of all the principals talking about what happened, but you don't see anybody's face like now. They never break not the illusion. They never break the focus or the frame of then. So it's all contemporary footage photographs. There's a little bit of stuff that they used computers to visualize. Some of the, you know, here's what it might have looked like for them outside the space shuttle, but most of it is all was filmed then. So it really keeps you in the moment. But, you know, her daughters, one of her daughters is recalling coming downstairs when they thought these guys were probably going to die and seeing her mom in the living room, like taking communion with a priest and other friends. And then they show you the photograph of that happening.
That sounds super cool. We'll definitely have to check that out.
Definitely check it out because, and I told David that you can tell that that was the angle that Middleton was interested in, was telling more about what was happening to her, for her. The other thing that was wild to me is the degree to which everything that happened with these guys was instantly broadcast to the entire world. And that is something that I feel like would not happen today. So anyway, it's called Apollo 13 Survival. Definitely worth an hour and a half of your time. And it's on Netflix.
Thanks, Katie. So my recommendation, like I said, big T11s fan. So I am going to recommend one of the Instagram reels that she put out during the kind of promotional blitz for her memoir, The Well-Trained Wife, that is about Tim Tebow and his girlfriend. One thing that she says in the memoir is that the church she went to in Florida, the Tebow family also went there, and that his mother was actually one of the women who mentored her into Gothardism. And so she talks about Tim Tebow recently signing copies of the book that his girlfriend wrote and how that's kind of an emblem of this particular kind of patriarchy in the Instagram reel. So I thought that was very interesting because while he is a conservative celebrity, that is kind of an angle on it that not a lot of people maybe know about. So I will link to that Instagram reel and everyone else's recommendations in the show notes. Thank you all for listening to the Christian Feminist Podcast. We'd love to hear from you. If you have topic or reading recommendations for future episodes, or if you just want to say hi, you can do so at christianfeministpodcast@gmail.com. You can also find us on our Facebook page or at the network's Twitter handle at CH Radio Network. Check out the show notes from this and other episodes at the Christian Humanist blog at christianhumanist.org. The Christian Feminist Podcast is a member of the Christian Humanist Radio Network. Kristen Filipic is our press liaison. For Katie and Laurie, I'm Victoria. Tune in soon for our next episode when we will discuss the short stories of Flannery O'Connor. Until then, in essentials unity, in non-essentials liberty, and in all things, love.